some people don't feel shame from disappointing others. And so being able to reframe the goal of you set the standard for something that you want to achieve. And when you don't hit that goal, you're not disappointing me, you're disappointing you. And so it no longer becomes about that other person, it becomes about them. And they're on a mission to prove to themselves that they can meet that goal.
Welcome to the How Leaders Think podcast, a show that transforms you by renewing your mind and giving you new ways to think. I am your host, Kenny Lang, and with me today is the Izzy Gentry. She is a crisis strategist and the founder of Made to Walk. She's a dynamic leader, a communicator, and a strategist, which is how George W. Bush would say it. With a wealth of experience spanning multiple industries, from political communications, God bless her, to media executive and nonprofit strategy roles. Bless her again. Certified in corporate crisis management, secondary trauma, that's like refried trauma, and ethics. She has a wealth of knowledge and expertise, and I'm happy to have her. Welcome to the show, Izzy.
Oh, I'm super excited to be here, Kenny. Thank you so much for having me.
We are going to have a blast. I think we had the episode before the episode, and we probably should have had that recording, but you know what? It's just the Lord saw it, and that's all that matters. But tell me, Izzy, what is on your mind?
What is on my mind? You know, I've just been super busy trying to navigate as a entrepreneur and being able to work with nonprofits in a lot of different spheres while homeschooling our youngest and then being present for my two older kids. So you get your hands kind of put into all kinds of crisis throughout the day, but it just makes you a better strategist, I think.
Yeah, I can empathize with that, with having a bunch of things going on, plate spinning at the same time, each with their own mini crises, you know, especially with children. It's like, oh no, someone looked at me wrong. Did you breathe in my eye? And the world is melting down. But you bring up something interesting about like all of those things makes you a great strategist. I heard someone I think Alex Hormozi said, all strategy is just the allocation of resources. And I'd be curious, what definition do you operate under when you think about strategy, or at least in the context of how you're helping nonprofits and others?
Yeah, I think the first thing is that you have to learn how to prioritize time. And I don't think that many people give individuals the opportunity to organize what that looks like. And so what tends to happen, especially in nonprofits, is that you become the catch-all. And then the more that you catch on, the more that you're trying to figure out, well, how much time do I prioritize to this? And how much time do I prioritize to that? And what's a main priority? And where do we begin to be functioning outside of just the busy work and being functioning outside of the burnout? Because then you're just burning at both ends. And then you got to go home and you've got to be present for a million more fires that are going on. Kid has a project, right. Husband has a birthday or whatever it may be. So I think that, you know, even looking at your home and trying to find ways to give everyone the attention that they deserve and be present with each person and each project that you have really helps you to understand that's what your employees and that's what your clients are also dealing with. And so you're just helping them to reframe the way they think about their work as opposed to feeling overwhelmed or feel like they can't manage it.
Gotcha. So for you, strategy comes down to, it is resource allocation, but specifically the resource of time. Because if you commit to too many things, you can go to a lot of different things, but each one carries with it sort of like a cognitive debt of like, it's like the meme that says, it's like, I've got too many windows open and I don't know where the music is coming from. And so the funny version that I tell my clients of how I explain this is that you should whole ass only a couple of things and not half ass a lot of things.
Yes, that's exactly it.
But when you are a busy entrepreneur, parent, spouse, whatever, but especially with nonprofits, you know, which you and I have an affinity for, helping and serving, they can cling to, well, it's this, I'm on this mission, I'm doing good in the world. I'm not just making money, like I'm making meaning and you can justify your burnout as some sort of righteous badge mm-hmm. of honor. And I'm not saying that I'm not disrespecting anybody who's like worked their butt off and hip burnout. It's very real. It's very serious. I'm given to it. Izzy, I'm sure you've, you know, worked yourself until you're like, I'm going to punch somebody. And she's got a good reach, people. So just like, you know, stand back. She's surprisingly quick. But how can we start to reframe what is honorable in our work? If all these things are important, you know, I love saying if everything's important, nothing's important. And that's cool to say, but tough to live. Mm-hmm. How do we start to make these choices? How do we decide where our time goes? And then what I deal with, so maybe I'm getting some free therapy, but how do you deal with, you may be able to name the emotion better. I would maybe call it shame of not doing enough by the end of the day.
Yeah, so there you hit on like three really big points right there. So the first one is just the emotion that you're feeling, that shame. It's a cultural aspect. So in the West, our culture is really based on hitting that American goal, right? Which is just achieving as much as you can humanly possible and going at a speed that has no pause, no stop, no anything. And in different cultures, in, you know, different countries, they do have long pauses. They do see breaks and opportunities as a way to refresh and renew the worker. And so it's really just a matter of identifying that work is not our identity and the work that we do is not our identity. And so especially when you're doing some kind of ministry aspect or nonprofit work, you feel this overwhelming burden. If I step back, someone may get hurt. And the truth is that if you do not step back, someone will get hurt. It's not mm-hmm. the other way around. And so I've used this analogy before, and I'll say it a million times, that an advocate or an individual in nonprofit work, it is very similar to having your favorite beverage, a Coke, that you take out to the swimming pool and you are feeling refreshed by that. And it goes down to practically nothing and you leave it out in the sun and you get in the pool and someone else comes along and they're like, man, I'm so thirsty. And you hand them your can that is now disgusting warm. It is the worst tasting possible thing that you could drink. And they drink it and they're like, oh my God, this is horrible. This is the worst thing. Like, why would you give this to me? And you're thinking, well, I just gave you the last of what I have. I gave you everything that I had left. And they're saying that was worse than you not giving me a drink. And that is essentially what the work does, is when you don't take that step back, you are giving them the worst version. And so, especially if you're a church and you're having an off day and you're in burnout and someone comes for the very first time and they are in crisis and you're like, I'm sorry, I don't have time right now. That's what the first impression that they have from you, and they may never walk in those doors again. If you're a nonprofit that serves people who are in critical crisis and you've heard mm-hmm. that story a million times and someone else comes along with the same, hey, I'm having a hard time, blah, 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 and you're just like, oh, here we go again. And so it can really do more damage. And the other aspect of that is that we do not actually incorporate enough conversation about mental health in the workplace, period. And it doesn't matter if it's mm-hmm. corporate or nonprofit work, but essentially all corporations across the US, only 40% of them actually even have mental health options, even in the bereavement process. So even if you lost someone, would there even be resources? And only 15% of employees actually think that their employment cares about their mental health. So that actually increases your turnaround for up to 50% just having not enough mental health resources for your individuals, especially when they work in critical care units.
Jeez. I mean, at that high level, you add up the dollars. Mm-hmm. Payroll is the largest expense for any organization, typically. That we're talking, you know, across the board, that's billions of dollars
mm-hmm. yeah.
spent. I know I've been called in, the inciting pain has been high turnover and they're like, we got to stop this. And it's not, and by the way, the solution is not just pay people more or whatever. Like, yes, pay people something that is fair and reasonable. Because if you're not going to supply mental health support services or medical benefits or anything, like, give them the cash to go and acquire their own and make that decision. But there's a lot of other dimensions to compensation than just a financial. And it gets into what Dr. Timothy Clark, who wrote The Four Stages of Psychological Safety, talks about: the release of discretionary effort, not the I'm punching the clock. And it sounds like, based on those statistics, there's a very low level of psychological safety in these workplaces. Like, you don't care about me. I'm not going to bring anything up. I'm going to go here. I want to collect my check. And I want to bounce. Like, you're not getting a second more from me than I'm obligated to, which, if you think about it, like, businesses hate to think that's happening, but honestly, that person probably hates giving that amount. Like, most people that I've come across, I haven't found anybody who's opposite of this, apart from if I met a sociopath or something, and maybe I have, but I'm not pointing fingers or naming names, but people want that bigger purpose, that mission, even if they're in a for-profit world, even if they're not the entrepreneur, the founder, the executive, they want that connects with something deep within them, regardless of their faith orientation or belief system. It connects with something in them that they can't fully explain. To be able to give your effort to something that tapped into what makes you like awesome and gifted, but you also saw something positive come from your work. I just think that's inherent in every person. So if somebody's working, and in most cases, you and I are talking to and about people who are in that sort of executive leadership or are founders, I think that it is a cultural thing here in the West a lot more than it is, you know, in like European countries and things like that, where they get 5 weeks off a year is typical. Like, EU shuts down in like the month of August. Like, I've had clients that I was like, all right, so are we on for our August thing? Nope, we're all gone. I'm like, it's like, I'm still working though, so you better still pay. It's like, I hope your bank is still working, but I don't know, that it feels like we're doing a real disservice to people. Like, we are the creators of our own crises. Is that fair to say?
I think you definitely hit it right there, is that we wonder why we can't get good employees. We wonder why we can't make people really buy into our mission. We wonder why they're not displaying the vision that we want them to, or succeeding the goals that we set before them, but then we are not providing them the resources that they need. And so, just in my data diving, I really wanted to see, like, is there truly a demographic for the work that we do, which is essentially training, building training specific to being able to respond to all different kinds of crisis care. And the truth of the matter is that more than 40% of employees want to have more training. They want to feel like they're being, one, invested into, so that they're learning in their work environment. Says, my boss cares about my work and is investing into me. The second aspect of that is that they feel a sense of achievement, that they are learning something they didn't know before. And so now they have a revived passion for the work that they do, instead of that burnout of, oh, here I am again, another day of crisis. And then that third aspect is essentially, you see that they have just a profound more confidence. So they are working with a level of confidence that makes you feel confident as an employer in the people that you have in those positions, making less bad decisions, emotional decisions, tired decisions that can be high liability issues and then cost you legally. So these things really do play a part together. They really do speak to each other, and they make for a better environment for everyone involved.
Yeah, that I love that. The a couple of things came to mind. One is a quote. I think it was Jack Welch. I don't know. Somebody's going to fact check me and email me, but that's fine. But they were saying, it's like, hey, like, what happens if we train all these people and they leave? And he replied, what happens if we don't and they stay?
Yep.
And there was another, there's a study I've cited in a few presentations on just like leadership and developing people, that showed the first time somebody is given management position on average is in their early 30s, like 31, 32, something like that. Mm. The first time most people receive management or leadership training is when they're 42.
Mm. Wow. So 10 years.
Yeah, there's a 10-year gap between authority, wow, permission, influence given, and hey, let's actually train you on how to do this well. So I guess I would ask, in that training, is some of that revitalization, because I think Daniel Pink saw this in his book Drive, I want to say, that people thrive on having something that is a little challenging, like a sort of like a path to mastery. So is it that new training introduces new things I didn't even think I could attempt or try? Therefore, there's now some challenge. Is that a revitalizing feature? Is like, what if you had to pick a foundational ignition catalytic piece of training, investing in your people? What does that ultimately do? Because they can feel invested in, but I know plenty of people who would take $100 from me and just walk away and never say anything. Yeah. They did it to Jesus, so they'll do it to me. And I know I didn't compare myself to Jesus. I put myself a little lower, just so we're clear.
I think there's three ticking points to it. So one, yes, there's a level of mastery. It's I'm acquiring something that is outside of my realm of reason and finding out on my own. The second is like people really thrive on that aha moment of I've never thought about it like that, because you may be coming from a different worldview or you're educating them on someone else's perspective. I'll give you an example. Like I just did a training for probation officers and we were talking about kids and we were talking about trafficking specifically, but we were talking about kids and how they come to the conclusion of understanding their behaviors. And so half the room just erupted with, well, you punish that kid the first time and they'll never do it again. Like you just have to have a hard punishment. And I looked at them as probation officers and I just said to them, and how many of those rock bottom moments work for your clients? And they got really quiet. And I was like, how many returning probation clients do you have, even though they've been struck by the law? Then they got really quiet. And so when I reframed it from identifying, look, some people don't feel shame from disappointing others, but sometimes they feel shame with disappointing themselves. And so being able to reframe the goal of you set the standard for something that you want to achieve. And when you don't hit that goal, you're not disappointing me, you're disappointing you. And so it no longer becomes about that other person and becomes about them. And they're on a mission to prove to themselves that they can meet that goal. And that's something really empowering to tell yourself, I was able to do that and I am able to do more. And so there was a lot of like, I've never thought about it that way. And so I could see a revitalization. Mm-hmm. It's just a change in perspective. But as an employer, you want your employees to be able to take what they learn and then take it into the workplace, right? Because you don't want them to just sit through lunch and learn and then be like, okay, I didn't learn anything, and then go about my business.
Yeah.
So I love hearing people's feedback of going, hey, I took your training and this situation came up and I used what you said and it really worked. That's the moment where you realize like this is connecting. This is actually working in real life. And I will at times test my own training if I have built out a training and take it out into the workplace. In like when I went to North Carolina and we were working on recovery, I have a system of recovery and how this strategy is supposed to work in order for it to increase the productivity by, more than 200%. And I had an opportunity to put that to use. And I was a little nervous because I was like, maybe this doesn't, like, what if this doesn't work? And it was like such a game changer, because I saw the people that I was working with in the distribution center. When I got there, they had this incredible burden on them. And you could see that the room was just spinning and they didn't know where to start. And they didn't know how to manage all of these donations coming in and everything that was going on. And by the time I left, they were rejuvenated. They had like such amazing energy. They felt so incredibly motivated. And that's what you want to see. You want to see it actually activate your environment.
Yeah. If there isn't any behavior change, again, I listen to a ton of Alex Hormozi, so I quote him a bunch. Smart guy. But he said that if learning only takes place if behaviors change. So if your behavior didn't change, you didn't learn anything. And then he said the rate at which you change behavior is how he defines intelligence, is your ability to absorb the material and then implement and execute and change the behavior. And which again, that's a huge thesis behind this podcast, is like, let's reframe and then let's go, because we think differently, let's do differently. Even if it's a small experiment, because I can't tell you how many things that I'm good at now, but I sucked at the beginning. But because I heard someone say something, I was like, I'll give that a shot. You know, my wife has had several of those silencing moments with me about our children. She's just like, she's a baby whisperer and she's a phenomenal parent. But there's a lot of stuff where she's just paused and said, like, you're not getting through to them this way, like yelling or punishing harshly or doing this thing. Like, do you think that's working? I was like, no.
It should be.
It should
Everything
be.
On paper says it should. Okay.
And she's like, but I think this comes down to something I've been thinking a lot about. And I know that my job is to interview you, but what's on my mind,
I love it.
Some of it has just been, takes more time than we think.
Mm. Yes.
Because each person is different. And I do believe in a universal truth. I do believe that there are sound principles that apply to the vast majority of people. There are always going to be outliers. I do understand statistics. I wish more people did. But like raising kids, I can't do the same thing with all of them. I can have the same heart, but I can't have the same actions. Like I have two girls, three boys, and each one of them needs something different because they have different background. Two of my boys are adopted. They're going to feel and experience things. One of my sons is a different ethnicity from the rest of us. His experience growing up and what he's thinking is going to be different, and what we do with him. And we've had to have this talk with our other kids. They're like, well, you don't get on to so-and-so as much as you get on to us, and he gets away with this. And it was like, yeah, we're trying to balance discipline, but also recognize the trauma and things he's experienced that thankfully you never had to go through. Unfortunately, he did, but he's here with us now. And so it's just taking time to let that shell melt away, and for him to understand that if we get onto him, that we're not somehow unadopting him. Like, that's been a real fear, is that if we got mad or mad enough, we would sort of like, it's like an Amazon return thing. Like, we would just, you know, box him up and send him back. So I have to approach him much differently and much more gently than I do like my older 15-year-old, who I think I just have to like headbutt at this point, because he's hard-headed and I don't know where he got it from, but
no clue.
But I think a lot of, and I'm using a parenting analogy, and some people really don't like this, and those people can, never mind, I'm not going to insult them. But I think good parenting is good leadership, and good leadership is good parenting. And so I make those comparisons quite a lot. And some people feel like, oh, well, no, that's, you're being paternalistic or something like that, or treating people like children. It's like, no, that's just, how do you develop somebody? How do you, like, you're training, you're investing, you're developing latent potential in someone to become actualized so that they can do more, think more, achieve more at a higher level. It helps you as an organization, as your team, as your department, whatever business unit, but it also helps that individual. Not just now, but in the rest of their life, because someone can fire you and take your job, but they can't take your skills.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk from a training perspective? Because I know you think deeply about like training, facilitation, behavior change, but modification. Talk about that, the perception of what we think it should take to change, iterate, improve, level up, whatever, and what it actually takes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the first thing you have to realize is that your upper management needs the training first. I think what happens is upper management pays for training for lower employees because they're like, you learn it. I don't have time for this. And so what tends to happen is that the process is, there's a disconnect in communication simply because what one team is learning, the other team is not implementing. And so you have this huge discourse because they're going, well, we learned this, but you're doing this. So what are we supposed to be doing? And so that's where time comes into conflict, because now you're eating up time going, well, which is the right way to do it? The way you're telling me to do it, or the way we learned to do it, or the way the handbook says it, or the way the bylaws read it, or the way the whatever. So there's too many inconsistencies. When upper management takes the training and is really learning how to connect with their employees, they're able to really, truly be able to hone in. It's like asking a child to learn how to do parenting, right? You don't do that. You ask the parent to learn how to parent the child. And so that's the first part. That upper management needs to learn the process of communication. Then they can go into individualization, if you will, of what you're talking about. Because you're right, every employee is different. And every employee is going to be dealing with a different set of things. Some people can take on a ton. Like they can just, like I'm one of those people, like throw it at me and then get out of my way. Yeah. I love it. I love running at a speed of 1,000. Don't ask questions. I'm just going to get it done. And then there are certain people that are meticulous and they do one thing really well and they do it to completion in a perfectionistic way. And that's good too, but you have to know everyone's strengths and weaknesses. And when you approach conflict, it's a manner of learning how to stop listening to the sound of your own voice. And that comes from training, because if you know what to look for when you're looking at, watching your face, when you're looking at body language, when you're looking at the tone, when you're looking at response to what you're saying, those things really help to set the table of going, what does this employee need? What resources do they actually need? And what are they actually asking for? So what you may have is someone who has a really low decreased productivity level. And you're saying they're a worthless, useless employee and they're not doing their job. They need to be fired. And yet when you go to them and you sit down and you say, hey, tell me what's going on in your mind. Tell me about what your day is making you feel. And they start to express, I feel overwhelmed because now I feel like I'm doing a job that I didn't sign up for, or I'm being asked to do tasks that I haven't been shown how to do. And so it's eating up my time because I'm trying to figure it out or whatever it may be. Then you realize, hey, they may need a little bit of hand holding or assistance or additional resources or additional training or additional whatever, but you are able to listen and implement. And so it actually does increase productivity and it increases the connection, because then they go, my boss really listened to me and gave me the resources I needed to be supported and to be useful. And you are going to have those one-off occasions where people are like, I just don't care. And I don't care about the mission. I don't really care about being here and I want the paycheck. And you have to be confrontational enough to be able to say, hey, we care about you as an individual, but if you're not vested, you know, maybe this isn't the place for you. But it really does take a matter of learning how, when to speak and when to listen, because it will decrease the amount of time that you're spending either avoiding someone, avoiding a conflict, fighting with an employee to get them to do the thing that you want them to do, because there's not enough listening happening. Does that make sense? Am I making sense?
Lot there. But I think the big thing I heard through all of that is slowing down and taking the time is the way in which you build trust, and you can't really lead effectively. You can't have a high performance team or company if you haven't taken the time to develop trust, and trust doesn't develop quickly. You may get a little bit of like seed. I will seed you trust, or actually it may just be base level respect given to someone with a higher position or title. And that's great. Start there, but you can't stay there if you expect to be high performance. Something I've used with clients in the past, because I deal with people who are just really strong, like doers, operators. They're like, hey, just give me the list. Show me the brick walls. I'm running through them. Peace. I've got the people who are flaming visionaries, like they just see the future faster than everybody. But if they're not careful, they turn into arsonists and burn everything down. You've got processors who are the meticulous people, and there is a time and a place for that. And then you've got your your synergists who love to, let's make sure we're all harnessing these talents appropriately instead of being in a steel cage match with one another. Which, by the way, all the things I described, because as you were describing, I was like, shoot, has she been reading my material? But there, I have a leadership styles quiz, which, you know, we'll link in the show notes. That's free and it's 5 minutes, but it'll show you where you score on each of those four styles. But in the phrase I use with a lot of clients who do have some real, like, why am I in this meeting? Why are we taking all day to plan our strategy? I was like, because if you're going to go 100 miles an hour, you probably don't want to run into a wall, do you, Jeff? I don't have a client named Jeff. I made him up. He's fictitious. If you identify with Jeff, it was not about you. Unless you feel guilty and convicted, like in a good sermon, then that says more about you than what I was saying. These are the asides I make. But there's a quote from the Marine Corps Sniper School, or just that division of the Marine Corps. Slow is smooth, smooth is fast. And as someone who likes to go, I like, you say, going 1,000 miles an hour, I stole this from a former client's brother, is I'm going mock Jesus with my hair on fire. And by the way, that is a pace with which I'm very, very comfortable with. And I've discovered that there's not everybody is. And also, that's okay. So there was some judgment in my heart and I had to get right with God and Jesus. But that slowing down, I was like, do I care more about doing it the way I want or doing it effectively? And I think that there is a big difference between those. It's easier to do it the way I want. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, the way I want is much faster than other people are comfortable with. But if I don't slow down, then the thing doesn't get done.
Yeah.
And I think any leader listening to this, any founder, executive, or even if you're just a senior manager, your end goal is results. And that doesn't mean take anything that Izzy said and use it as manipulation. That makes you a jerk and you should quit and go walk in the woods and find yourself. But it does mean it's going to take longer and you're ultimately held accountable for whether or not these things get done well over a prolonged period of time. If your ambition and your goals and your drive take you to the executive suite or to start your own thing, mm-hmm. you're going to want all of that, those good things, those good lessons. There is one thing I'd love you to address in all of that. Speaking of going mock Jesus with your hair on fire, there are people, and you and I have talked about this probably at length over coffee at the Panera. It's I put the in front of things just to show people I'm a little bit older, because otherwise they think I'm 12. But we talked about people needing to slow down and then, you know, how do you balance all these things and burnout? I don't have this fully formed or baked yet, but something I've been trying to work through is not falling in the other ditch of all the high capacity, high drive people are shaming all those coming along or not as ambitious or anything like that. And I think that there's another ditch where we just shame people for being like really gung-ho and full of energy to get things done and achieve this and make this happen. I think we swing into the other ditch and glorify at its worst, it glorifies laziness.
Mm-hmm. But sure.
I guess this could be to that high drive individual, and even to those who are around and know and love the high drive individual, because the common wisdom, the prevailing wisdom is you got to slow down and, oh, don't you just, yeah, you got to have work-life balance, which makes me vomit even as I say it. And I'm like,
you don't.
I don't. I literally had to tell a client.
What you do have to do is you do have to communicate. And like, and not to interject, I know you're going to finish your thought, but I'm hearing you talk and I think every single one of us is created with an intentionality. Mm-hmm. And that intentionality is not equal. And so depending on what your ethical balance is and, you know, who your ethical following is, you know, you're going to have a different view on this. But the main rule about ethics is that, one, it's subjective. Okay. So whether you think that someone should be operating in a certain level or should be, you know, given some level of access or whatever it is, it's a subjective viewpoint. And so when you can reduce your expectations of people and see them for the qualities that they possess, and then increase those qualities by strengthening them, that's going to be your superpower. Because if you can really see that in other people and strengthen that, you're going to be able to use it to the best advantage. The greatest architects of business out there will tell you that if I'm in the room and I'm the smartest person in the room, I'm in the wrong room. You want experts in every single field. And so you have to not be competitive. You cannot be comparing. You cannot be envious of that person showboating or whatever it is. You have to know this person's brought into the room because they're an expert in this field. This person's brought into the room because they're an expert in this field, and so on and so forth. But also understanding how to communicate your strengths and your weaknesses. So before I ever even walk into a nonprofit, I tell them, you have to tell all of your employees how quickly I move, because they're going to come in and they're going to feel like, whoa, what is she here to do? Like, what is happening right now? And they're going to feel completely overwhelmed.
Yeah.
My job is to, and I tell them, I'm not here to make you think I'm here to find problems. I am here to find problems. It's my job to find problems, because I have to fix those problems so that they don't become the public's problem. Right?
Right.
So it is my job to find problems, but it's also my job to find solutions to those problems and to implement them in a way that is attainable and is something that you guys can be able to manage long after I'm gone. I'm not here to kick you out of your job. I'm not here to make you feel less than. I am here to find the problems and fix them. And so when you can communicate that, I think it does help to ease some of the personality differences. As long as leadership also understands their component, which is to bring in experts and to not feel compelled to compete with those experts.
That's really good. I should probably start giving people a warning before I come into their organization.
like, I think my warning.
I have friends who warn.
Acknowledge.
Yeah. Actually, I have people who warn others when they introduce me, and I don't know what that's about, and just social situations. So maybe I need to do some reflecting on that outside of this podcast. But I'm thinking right now of the listener. They're high capacity, high drive individual. And they say, like, I want to do things well. I love working, and I believe in my work and what I'm doing. But it feels like everybody around me is telling me I need to slow down. I need to smell the roses. I actually found a meme. I'll send it to you. But it's just a 4-panel cartoon meme that says, "Hey, pal," and it shows somebody running and another person kind of walking. It says, "Hey, you need to slow down and smell the roses." And the next frame, they look at them, they look back, and then you see the person like aggressively smelling roses. And then in the final frame, they're holding up a trophy that says first place for rose smelling. But and I know that that's taken to like an extreme. But you can almost feel like there's something wrong with you because everyone around you is telling you, stop, slow down, smell the roses. You don't have to do all of this. And trying to communicate effectively, no, there's this. And if I do this, then this happens. And I see these things. I personally struggle a lot with that. I had to tell a client this morning. It's funny. He's a client, but he used to mentor me for a season too. He still will, because he's rudely insightful, but like a few other people I know. But I said, I've been working a lot. I've been doing this, and I'm fortunate to have a very understanding wife. But I know not every relationship could function like ours. And even with the understanding, I still love to work. Like even over the weekend, I was like, oh, it's a weekend. My anniversary was Friday. It's a 3-day weekend. I get to do this. On Saturday, I hung out a little bit. And then I read and watched stuff on for a project I'm working on for like 4 or 5 hours. Like it is almost a compulsion. And I've talked to a lot of people who feel wired that way. But I think people hear, well, you got to have mental health in the business, you know, mental health care and concern, and we got to slow down and we got to do this. It almost feels like, I actually don't think that there's a place for me here, right? And that's sort of like the other ditch. If you were sitting down talking to that person, which technically you kind of are, like, what do you, because, and you're one of those people too, so you could just hold up a mirror. and talk to yourself, and then you wouldn't feel so judgmental.
I will tell you my self-speech.
Could you speak to yourself, but really to help that person? Because that's a frustrating thing as well. Like, shaming people because they're not as fast as you is, I think, just as wrong as shaming someone because they're more ambitious than you.
Yeah, no, I know the feeling very well. It's a very, it's almost like people feel an energy and they don't know what to do with it. And they're either very competitive with it, or they just feel like you're different than everybody else. Like, there's something off about you. And I think that what is hard for most people, sorry, I'm going to switch to my other earpiece because this one's not loving me right now. What I think for most people is that they are constantly looking at other people's expressions towards them, right? They're like, if I've heard it enough times, something must be true. Like, there must be some truth to it. But I tend to think of is that when you have heard a specific, like, it is specific. Let's just say, for example, I kept hearing when I moved from California to Texas and I took over an executive position, I think subjectively that it's very rude to send an email with a bunch of fluff in it that wastes people's time. So I just would cut the chain. Okay. And I would just be like, and also at the same time, I was writing scripts. Well, when you write any kind of marketing script, like for radio, you have to use all caps. So I would be working on multiple computers at the speed of light, and I would switch to an email and I would leave my all caps on, and I would send me this file in all caps. And my assistant, like, bless her heart, I'm so grateful for her, because she just knew me. She knew that I was, like, so approachable, sweetest person to work with. But, like, people would come into her office, like, almost in tears, and they would say, oh my gosh, is Izzy mad at me? Like, did I do something wrong? Because I got an email in all caps. She's like, no, she's writing scripts and just left her all caps on. Like, it's not even a big deal. And so I had to, when I heard that enough times, I thought, whoa, I've got to slow down. I've got to be able to, like, take my computer cap lock off. Like, I can slow down enough to do that. Okay. So when you hear, like, a specific thing, I think you do have to take that into consideration. But when people are just telling you that your personality is different, like, you're going too fast, you need to slow down, you need to smell the roses, I really find that insulting to the fact that, like, God made me this way, you know, and it's the part of you that just wants to be like, catch up. But I was really convicted when I kept pushing myself to the point where, which you're talking about, where I couldn't sit with my family, and I would catch myself in a movie, like watching a movie with my kids, with my laptop on my lap, and I was drafting out things, and I was like, why? Like, why can't I just put it down? Why can't I just do it with my family? Like, why? Why can't I just do it? And I really felt convicted, regardless of what your spiritual belief system is, that I felt like God was like, you think that you have to do it because I can't do it. And I was like, oh, okay, so now I'm like, oh God, like, I'm like, you dying on the cross wasn't enough. I have to, like, save the world myself. So if I don't respond to this client, if I don't respond to this text, if I don't whatever, like, I am going to feel this guilt. And he's, but who are you? Like, you are the vessel in which I've chosen to do the work that I've asked you to do. I haven't asked you to do it to, like, kill yourself over, essentially. And that's really important why he gives us the Sabbath and why he's intentional about that. It's really important how he sits down and he breaks bread with his disciples and he converses, and that communication and that fellowship is just as important as teaching them the principles of the ethical belief systems that they're going to learn. But he's a practical God. And so when he raises the child from the dead, he doesn't say, okay, now everyone sit down, I'm going to teach you how to, like, do this. He says, give this girl something to eat. You know, like, he's practical. And so I have to learn the balance between my work as being, like, I'm ethically called to this work, and also I have to leave space for God to be God. Because then if not, then it's just me doing it in works. And it's just me doing it for me and my own pride and my own selfishness. So my humility isn't in people telling me to slow down. My humility is saying, God, I'm leaving space for you to do something miraculous that doesn't require me to figure out a solution to this. And that might be financial, or that might be like the trajectory of our organization, or that just might be like every year, even with our homeschooling, me and my husband, we go away to a homeschool convention for like 3 days. And we do that because our intention is to reset and to rethink and to repurposeful. And so I have to leave space for God. That's just my core belief system. And it's really changed, I think, how I respond to things, that I don't have to be constantly like fire drill. I have to do this right now. And it does take some intentionality. I've had to turn my phone to like do not disturb and miss some things, you know, when it's appropriate. Now, if you are working for a suicide hotline and you are the manager, I'm not telling you to turn your phone off, because obviously there are certain
maybe not
that do not allow for you to have that time to just check out. But yeah.
Dang. Felt like this probably has more to do with my marketing mind than anything else, as like separating the difference between your work and your worth. And to be honest, I shared it on a couple of LinkedIn posts. I think one in particular was a video I recorded earlier this year, was some of that humbling, like just reaching a place given the death my family had experienced, the multiple brain surgeries my wife has already had in the last 5-6 months, and just different things with our kids and business and a church leadership and stuff that needed. It just reached the end of that. And I was like, but if I don't, like, the world will stop spinning. And getting to that same place of my version of what you heard was feeling like God said, I want to do things in such a way that only I can take credit.
That's right.
And I was like, dude, I'm out. I'm the face of this operation.
I love how many times biblically he says, and then they will know that I am the God of Israel. And I have to know that. Like, yes, he gave me skill, and he gives some of us out there are going to be the Esthers and the Daniels and the Radshach, Meshachs, and Abednegoes, and, you know, they're going to step out. But then I also think of the rooms they step into, of how many people didn't step out. And that's a lot more than the people who did. And it's not to say that anyone is less than or more than. It's not the ethical belief system that I personally lean into, but it is saying that more than not, you are going to see the world in a way that has a different balance for you of what you are willing to sacrifice or what you're willing to risk.
Yeah. We have covered a lot, and there's more to come, and maybe even we're birthing another podcast. That's sort of a funny fake maybe thing. I'll leave that as a teaser. That's going to be the one clip that everybody picks up on, not the other wisdom, just the fact that I'm advertising that. So somebody's listening to this and they're like, okay, gotcha. My mental health matters. Staying in the fight matters. Whether I feel like I'm driven like a Ferrari, or I'm reliable like a Honda Accord, however I'm made and designed, figuring out how I'm wired, and then how, if I'm a leader, how do I develop that person? This is aimed at leaders, but how do I slow down and do this, which feels painstaking? If somebody wanted to get started down this road of really their own development, right? It's sort of like the classic airplane thing, like put your oxygen mask on first. Where would you advise someone start something that they could do in the next 24 hours, spending little to no money, to get started down this type of development?
Yeah, I have a workbook called Biblical Crisis Management that people can do to process. If you are a believer or a nonprofit that has faith roots, you can be able to dissect how you analyze and in pre-mortem thinking. And if you're not familiar with pre-mortem thinking, it's essentially thinking of every possible thing that could go wrong and then solving backwards. And I think that when we learn to think in a pre-mortem thinking, you realize that some things are just not that critical. And some things call for us to be more proactive so that they are less critical. And so yeah. You'll stop that burnout. You'll start that extreme firefighter mentality when you can start to implement more pre-mortem thinking and a lot more of that proactive solution so that you're not constantly putting fires out. And most leaders think to themselves, I will deal with it when I get there, or we will deal with that problem once it happens. And so what you'd end up doing is you really start working backwards and it becomes very expensive, very time consuming. And then you're trying to rebuild a culture and you're trying to rebuild. And it's just, it's exhausting. And a lot of employees don't buy into it because they've been doing it a certain way for a long time. And now you're changing the game because of one person or one mistake or whatever it is. So it's really important for leaders in a position of leadership to learn how to manage that. But if you're talking about just specifically how to manage yourself, the first thing you have to do is a self-check. I mean, I am devastated when I hear any CEO who they hit a financial bump that they missed, or a pastor who's hit, you know, a wall or whatever it is, and the only option they feel is suicide. I'm so like just burdened by that as as a country. Like, we should not even be, that should not even be an option. And it really just becomes that we are not humble enough to identify those things. And I've felt them. Like, I have literally been in situations where I have taken on so much and I'm like, I got it. And I'm working at perfect capacity. And then I start getting like TMJ and muscle spasms and like sleep issues and other things. And my body is saying, you may be functioning, but like, I'm shutting down. I'm done. So
body keeps the score.
And so again, that is in the back of the workbook, but you could also just look it up. You can find a lot of free training resources at madetowalk.org. If you click on media, we have a lot of blogs that you can go through if you're dealing with something specific that you're not even really sure if it's affecting your workplace environment. Maybe you're dealing with bereavement. Maybe you're dealing with just your own childhood experiences. You're trying to find your place in adulthood and trying to find your place even sometimes amongst other employees that can make you question your leadership ability. And so it can help you to self-process, but look up that list and really take that into consideration of whether or not you should yourself be seeing a counselor, because it's really important. What you don't realize is that you're going to tell yourself that you're functioning fine and that you're doing fine. But to the outside world, they're kind of looking at you like you're more irritable, you're more, you know, you're more exhausting, you're not making sense, you've got fogginess, and there's a lot of things that can take place until it gets to the point where it really does affect the workplace. You can have full blackouts, you can have full, all kinds of things. And it's just because you're taking on too much. You have compassion fatigue or secondary trauma or just burnout, whatever you want to call it. It has a lot of the same symptoms. So yeah, that's what I would first recommend.
I love it. There's so much goodness there that could spin off into a whole separate episode. I have a feeling that there will be an episode 2, The Return of Izzy. So that sounds foreboding. I'll workshop the title. But
Izzy, it's a great Netflix special.
That does sound like, if somebody did want to know more about you, you've mentioned madetowalk.org. You mentioned your book, Biblical Crisis Management. We're going to have a link to the Amazon listing there. Is there anywhere else that if people want to know more about you or learn what you're doing, consume content, where would you send them?
I'm pretty much on everything except for X. I'm not very good at posting on X, but I am on Instagram. I'm Made to Walk, Facebook, Made to Walk, and TikTok. That's like the main things that I'm on. But you can also reach out if you're looking for any kind of internal review or executive director review or board management review. You can reach out to us. My email is izzy@madetowalk.org.
Fantastic. And full disclosure, listeners, I have worked with Izzy in the past, and she is as sharp as she sounds. And so don't wait. Call today. But she is phenomenal. She's very, very sharp, and she will help you and get results. She's not a consultant who comes in with a bunch of fluff, and Lord knows we don't need any more of those. But Thank you so much, Izzy, for sharing your time and your wisdom with us. Thank you so much for hanging out. I hope that you were entertained and impacted all at the same confusing time. Not really. I want you to have clarity. But if you like this, if you got something from this, it would mean a lot to me if you would like, rate, review, subscribe, whatever the right button is on your platform of choice. Reason being, one, I want feedback. Leave comments. You know, are there conversations, topics you want to hear about? Because as much fun as I have doing this, I do it for you. And if it's not driving results for you, then what the heck am I even doing? And this gets the podcast in front of more people who are like you, who are on their leadership journey, and you never know when a particular conversation may just unlock their next step, and you got to help that person for free. And wouldn't that make you feel warm and fuzzy inside? But until next time, change the way you think, you'll change the way you lead. We'll see you.